first Beatles song. Love Me Do, I think it was, and from there it didn't take him long. Got himself a guitar, used to play every night. Now he's in a rock and roll outfit and everything's alright. Don't you know?
This is Comics Therapy, episode 23. No reviews, just analysis. Up this week, we're taking a look back at 2013 our own way, introspectively, and with alcohol. On the couch, we talked with Eisner Award-winning writer and artist team, Paul Tobin and Colleen Coover. Just as a reminder, we don't do reviews, especially not this week, but we do talk a lot, so there may be spoilers from here on out. So just make sure you've read every book from 2013.
Already. Okay.
Here are my top 10 moments in comics that impacted me the most in 2013. 10 through 6, these brought the feels. Number 10, Batman and Robin, number 18. Requiem was an evocative and beautifully silent issue. Number 9, Demeter, created a beautiful and inescapable dread, ending in the final Number 8, Batman 17, page 13. Bruce confronts Damian. Perfect father and son moment set. Number 7, The Witching Hour. One shot. Pages 28 through 35. The Witch's Work Saga is the first time I've seen a comic book story with such an abusive trigger warning, and appropriately so, I should add. I couldn't believe I was reading such a raw story of trauma in a mainstream comic. Number 6, Mind MGMT. Number 4, page 17. Are you there? What a great moment of breaking the fourth wall. Not sure if it was in 2013, but that's when I read it. 5 through 1, coming up.
Welcome to Comics Therapy. Neither Aaron nor I are licensed therapists, so don't take anything we say seriously. This week, we present our introspective year in review, a special segment where we only consider what the year in comics meant to us. You know, feelings. It's not about rankings or lists of best of anything. It's about the moments throughout the year that really impacted us individually as readers. Aaron and I each picked a couple of themes, and we're going to talk about some specific comics from 2013 that made us think about that stuff. It was an intensely personal exercise, but we promise not to get too heavy. Plus, we're both drinking.
Yeah.
What are you drinking, Aaron?
I am drinking only the finest of bourbons.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Which is what?
It's called Old Crow.
Ah, fancy.
Just not Young Crow.
Right. Right. Just straight up. You're just drinking bourbon, like, from the bottle?
Yeah, I'm a man.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Right? What are you drinking? Shirley Temples?
No. Shirley Temples don't even have any alcohol in them.
I wouldn't know. I've never had one.
I am drinking Irish coffee.
Oh, that's cheating.
Well, I had a couple of shots before I started drinking the coffee part, but I can't really handle whiskey without a mixer. So, You know, I kind of cheated with the remainder.
It's like the fancy person's Four Loko?
Wow. I guess when you put it like that, absolutely.
Right? Because it's alcohol and caffeine?
Right.
You're just too good for Four Loko.
I don't think you can get it anymore. I don't think it's a matter of being too good. I think it's... like, I'm actually not good enough. I'm not cool enough to have access to the Four Loko thing anymore.
Okay.
I missed out on that.
Anyway.
Feelings. Nothing more than feelings. This is at Charming Rat on Twitter, the mom who reads comics. Hey guys, there's a lot of books that have actually made me cry this year, which is not something I normally do while reading comics. From Captain Marvel to The Wake, I just find myself tearing up all over the place. But the book that has made me the most emotional and made me feel the broadest spectrum of feelings this year has to be Fearless Defenders. From flat-out humor to really emotional and tender moments between characters or even losing characters, this book will be leaving a big hole in my heart for the next year since we will no longer have it.
In between segments, your very own nerd confessions, celebrating the geeky things we all do, say, read, and enjoy. This week's prompt asks listeners to share the same thing we're talking about. Major reading moments from 2013. You can call, Skype, or email your confessions. All the details are on the website comicstherapy.com, and we're posting the weekly theme on the site, on Twitter, and on Facebook for your convenience. The rest is up to you. Remember, catharsis is cool.
In between shows, you can find me on Twitter at Andrea Schock and Aaron at Aaron Myers, and of course the show account at Comics Therapy. So is there anything that you want to share about your week before we get this party started, Aaron?
I bought some GoBots today.
Yes, you did. That's awesome.
Yeah, I forgot. I haven't had those GoBots for a long time. They are super crappy. They do not even, like, transform at all. They're just
mighty
little
robots, mighty vehicles. Man, I know. You're ruining my childhood.
I had a bunch of those. I had the command center. I had the little carrying case that I bought again today.
Yeah.
I had a whole bunch of them. In my mind, they were way cooler than what I bought today. They're, like, the car has, like, two articulating arms, and that's about it.
Mm-hmm.
And the spaceship is just a spaceship, except it kind of separates in the middle to kind of show two legs. But that's all it does.
So, be honest. Did you buy these for you, or did you buy these for Luke?
Oh, no. They're for me.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's
those
fair.
Those are fully for me.
Okay.
Plus, he's got way cooler toys than that. They're not even fun.
He has actual Transformers?
Yeah. I let him play with it, and he's like, okay, I'm done. It wasn't even interesting.
I remember mixing GoBots and Transformers when I was a kid, and being, like, vastly less discriminating.
Oh, yeah. I had both. I mean, I had Transformers and GoBots. I don't know, for some reason, maybe I thought I liked them better, but maybe they were just cheaper, so they were easier to buy.
I also think that there's a huge dose of nostalgia with any of the stuff that we grew up with. When you run across it again, you're like, oh man, that's awesome, it's GoBots, and then it's not as awesome because you're not 8.
Right, exactly. I mean, I bought it just for the nostalgia factor. I mean,
right.
Why do I buy it? Most of the toys that I buy are just for the nostalgia factor.
Right.
Yeah, it's fine. I mean, whatever. It's $10 for the carrying case and two GoBots.
I've been really, I mean, this is totally not comics related, but we keep seeing slot cars at toy stores, and there's like a place near us outside of San Francisco that has,
the slot car track?
Well, it's, what's so bizarre is that it's not a toy store. It's not even a hobby shop. It's like a vacuum repair store.
Weird.
But in the front window, they have like a whole elaborate slot car setup. Mm-hmm. And I guess that there's like a club that meets there every couple of weeks, and they do little slot car races. And I think that's fucking awesome.
I remember, like, slot cars were huge.
Yeah.
In the late 80s, I guess.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And there was one of those, like, it was a hobby shop, but it was dedicated to slot cars. And I never got to play any of them, but we'd go by and I'd see all these, you know, happy families playing slot cars, and I'd look at them like, oh, that's so cool.
That's so sad.
Yeah, but slot cars suck.
No way.
They totally do. It's such a throwback. Like, there's so much just, like, look, you can buy a helicopter, a remote control helicopter, for $20 now.
Right.
I mean, compare that to, like, slot cars.
Well, how much are slot cars?
Those are expensive. Those, like, professional, like, you know, the quote-unquote professional hobby ones.
Right.
They're not that cheap.
Right.
There's the whole hobby built around it. So, like, you'd customize them and get better ones and get better,
sure,
like, controllers and everything else.
My little brother did obviously not have, like, the fancy customizable kind. But I remember it being, like, you could buy a set. You could buy, like, the track and a couple of cars. And then if you were so inclined, you could buy a couple of more cars so you could play with friends when they came over.
Yeah. No, I had one of those, and we returned it because it worked so poorly. Like, the cars were just flying off the track constantly, and, like, or it would stop working. It just, like, wasn't reliable at all. So, I don't really, I only have bitterness in my heart towards slot cars.
So, you're saying that my nostalgia is, like, not, it's misplaced.
I'm just saying your nostalgia is invalid. Just like your feelings.
My feelings, my nostalgia, mm-hmm, my opinion in the matter is just irrelevant.
Yeah. Right.
Okay? I'm glad that we're starting this entire episode off with, like, that in place.
Well, we are reflecting on the year, and that was a common theme.
Yeah. Awesome. Do you want to talk about the year?
Yeah, let's talk about the year. How about you start?
Okay. Well, I mean, just to make it clear, this was hard for you, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I don't really like to think about my own feelings.
Right.
I'd rather just...
You prefer making fun of me for mine.
Right. I mean, that's the more interesting part of the show.
Right. Right. But in this particular case, I thought it was actually kind of an interesting exercise to, like, categorize some of the things that we've been reading and put a personal spin on, like, trends in our own reading. But...
Well, to be honest, like, jokes aside, really the hard part for me is to remember things from the year, like series. Like, I can talk about things if I'm reminded of them or something puts it at the forefront, but it's hard for me to, like, go back and think of all the comics that I read this year, especially, like, miniseries, you know, or just graphic novels, that sort of thing. You know, things that are not ongoing that I'm seeing at least once a month or twice a month.
No, I agree. I mean, joking aside, that is a difficult thing for me in any case, but when you're trying to look at a body of work, like, chronologically, I agree. It's a little bit of a challenge to try to... I want to stress that we're not ranking, that was never the intention, but at the same time, in order to put anything into, like, a category, you have to try to at least assess the entire, you know.
Yeah, or if we have a theme, it's the things that I'm going to think of that might fall within that theme are going to be things that I read fairly recently, you know.
Right.
It's hard to then what was the hardest was just taking the time to try to find some lists from this year so I could remind myself of things that I read this year.
Did you look at best of lists to help you remember?
Some that I found, like, you know, I wasn't so much the best of for, like, ongoing series, because those I can kind of remember. It was more best of for miniseries. Like, that's the kind of stuff I was trying to remember, things that might have ended, you know, 3 or 4 months ago or 6 months ago or something like that.
Right.
That I wanted, because most of that stuff will just go into the blur of history. It could have been this year, it could have been, you know, 5 years ago or something.
Right. That's kind of sad, actually.
I don't know. Comics are very in the moment in a lot of ways.
Sure.
And, I mean, it's not bragging. It's not anything. I mean, I read, you know, 120 different titles a month. And, you know, whatever, 20 of those might end in a month and 20 new ones might start up in a month. And so that's a lot of kind of turnover in the comics industry.
That's interesting. I think that it's pretty clear to me, and if it isn't clear to our listeners, you and I read in a different way every week. It's not a matter of quantity, and it would be a funny joke, but it's actually not even a matter of quality. We approach the reading process in a different way. So, like, my first example for my first theme is something that I read months ago that was so vivid that I can't stop thinking about it. It is something that I continue to return to. It is something that we've talked about before, but it was such a, like, presence in the kinds of books that I read this year that there was no need for me to reflect on a list of other things that were published, because this was, like, an obvious go-to.
Yeah, but I read issues, and you tend to catch up on series.
Well, fine.
Well, but that's different.
You think that changes the impact?
Absolutely, yeah. Because an issue can have an impact in the moment, but... if you have a whole trade or, say, you know, 12 to catch up on, a particular issue might have a lot of significance, and then it's reinforced by the rest of the reading.
Just
so it's going
to
stick with you.
It's pretty rare when I have 12 to catch up on.
Or even three or four, whatever. You're reading,
right.
You're reading an arc as opposed to an issue, and that's one issue of, you know, 20 to 30 that you're going to read that day.
Okay. That's fair.
And I would agree, maybe there's something lost in the not being able to savor, you know, stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I enjoy the Wednesday stack of comics and reading these kind of serials and then talking about them with people. But the emotional impact of a particular issue isn't going to be as significant as it is going to be for somebody who's reading an entire story.
Okay, I accept that.
Good.
Do you want me to start?
Yeah, we can move on then.
Some of the comic moments that caused a rare emotional response for me were the end of Geoff Johns' run on Green Lantern, the end of the Amazing Lock and Key story, part of Thor 12 involving him and Jane Foster and pretty much all of Captain Marvel number 17. I'm sure there were more, but those were the big ones. Chris Hogan at Unlikely Nerd.
So the first theme that I wanted to talk about that was really important to me as a reader this year is the issue of mortality. Up until really recently, I know that I would not have described it as such, but I realized that a lot of the anxiety that I have about dystopian fiction, which I've talked about before, and, you know, zombie apocalypses, obviously, it's really much more basic than that. It's a straight up fear of death, and specifically the loss of control over one's own engagement with death. So I read a number of things in 2013 that kind of forced me to think about that more than I normally would. And the most striking example, the one I was just referring to, is The Massive Number 5, which it's written by Brian Wood, and it's totally cheating. I get that. It actually came out in October 2012, but I didn't read it until 2013, right? Because I'm always playing catch up.
Mm-hmm.
And I also already mentioned it when we talked about the series back in August, but, like, seriously, it is the single defining moment from, I think, and I know that this is saying something pretty extreme, but I think it is the single moment from everything I've read this year that I keep returning to again and again. Mary and Ryan are being forced to jump to their deaths. They are standing at a hole cut in the ice at a research station that they had used before as a refuge that has been taken over. And Ryan is, like, understandably out of her mind with fear. And Mary explains that she has to do two things. Ryan has to do two things. She has to trust and accept. And it is so fucking powerful, because Ryan has to accept the fact that she's going to die and not panic about it. And yet also trust that Mary is going to save her. And, like, that moment when I read it gave me chills, when I reread it gave me chills, and every time since then has been the point at which I compare all of those other characters who are in kind of similar opportunities to embrace their mortality. Like, it always goes back to that issue.
Mm-hmm.
And it's come up a bunch in other books, but, like, with kind of similar feelings. But that one, I think because, I mean, it works out okay, right? Like, everything ends up being fine in that moment. But yet, the fact that Ryan is in control of her own, I don't want to say destiny, because she's, like, very much reliant on Mary to save her. But yet, Ryan has to trust that her death in that moment is going to be, like, reversible is insane to me.
Well, and it's a secular moment of faith.
It is. It is. That's a really good way of putting it.
You know, and that's what a lot of these kind of things are, too. They're not necessarily, like, faith is a very religious connotation. But you can have non-spiritual moments of faith. You know, trusting in a higher power other than yourself is hard. And it's also a growth moment for a lot of literary characters. And I think it's, you know, meant to be for people in general, that you are not really in control of your fate most of the time, even though we have the illusion that we are. And you having to accept that is not easy.
Well, sure. I mean, it's a fairly common point in a character's development where they have to hit rock bottom before they're going to start to grow. Or it's not until they accept that they don't have the strength to overcome adversity that they somehow then gain the strength to overcome adversity. Like, that's a pretty typical, I don't know, like,
literary trope.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
Yeah.
So,
But often, it's not so much the trusting in something else, it's the finding the inner strength to overcome the adversity.
Well, and it's also so typical that it doesn't, it's like predictable in a lot of cases. You give a character like nothing to work with, and the only thing that they're going to be able to do is look inward.
Yeah.
And you put them down in the midst of like fucking zombies everywhere, and what are they going to do except find the strength within to like deal first with the zombies and then with like the other terrible people around them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that when it's such a common way of exploring kind of the human experience, that's why when a moment like in The Massive really sticks with me, like that's why I'm drawing attention to it, because it was unusually poignant in this kind of manufactured trope.
No, I agree. It's a very intense moment, and you feel that like that slipping away and that coming back. It's also metaphorical for the whole story too, of the Earth itself kind of falling apart.
Sure. So there were a couple of other books, just to, I guess, make this more relevant to the past year of published work, besides The Walking Dead, which is another obvious example, and I'm not current on it.
Mm-hmm.
But from 2013 specifically, books like Animal Man and Number Crunchers, The Dream Merchant, which, goddamn, I missed that book. I wish it would come back.
Yeah.
And even The Fabulous Killjoys, which has a like lighter approach to dystopian fiction, if you can call it that.
Yeah.
I'm definitely leaving some other examples out, but I think for me this past year, this was a story type that had previously been pretty unappealing to me. That put a lot of like my own personal anxieties at the forefront, and it's like not always fun to watch characters struggle with things that you struggle with yourself. So in contrast, I actually got a lot of enjoyment out of seeing characters accept their own mortality and like be empowered by that in some of those examples, like in Animal Man, and like kind of reaching rock bottom, and in The Dream Merchant, where the main character has to kind of like accept that he's the only one who can do anything about the situation, despite how insane it is and scary it is and how it's been plaguing him his entire life. Like, what are you going to do? Curl up in a ball and just avoid it? It's not really an option when you are the only choice.
Yeah, it's true. Or it's the sink or swim.
Yeah, but it's just, that's not something that most people ever really deal with.
No, like, but we do like to read about it, because we know it's always a possibility, and that's what these sort of superhero or, you know, fantastical books exemplify.
Right. But for the most part, it's not really a possibility. It's something that very few people have the need or luxury, although that makes it sound far more positive than I mean, but like very few people are ever in their lives put into that position.
True. I mean, thankfully so.
Right.
So. At least here in the first world.
Right.
I mean, it's true. You know, we have a very pretty insular kind of view of adversity and, you know, dire situations and that sort of thing.
Sure. But they can also be very, you know, they can be like mental constructs as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And all those books kind of exemplify that. Can we talk about me for a little while now?
Of course.
Thank you.
It's your friend Mike Garvey, also known as Avant Garve on the Twitters. Just calling in to say Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays. And a quick run through of five feels that the comic books gave me this year. Couldn't narrow it down to just one. So the first was Green Lantern New Guardians 23 with the destruction of the Blue Lantern Corps. That was pretty sad. Also, Captain Marvel 17, end of that series. Yeah, a few tears there. Buzzkill, specifically the last page of issue 3 and all of issue 4, because memories of good old dad. And Let's not also forget Justice League 24, which gave us a one-panel shot of the Doom Patrol in the New 52. Pretty excited about that. And Age of Ultron, which elicited quite a groan from the end of it, and lots of eye-rolling, which is still a feel. Anyway, thanks again for the show this year. It's been lots of fun and really enjoyable. And catch up with you guys in 2014. Thanks.
So yeah, we talked about earlier, like, this isn't easy just because it's hard to... I don't like to be super introspective on myself, number one. But it's also hard to go back and find things that really were significant, even though there's tons of stuff that was significant to me. I don't want to make it seem like I just read something and I toss it away. Or, you know, bag and board it properly and put it in a box.
Right.
But... it's still hard for me to kind of not think in the moment, especially this year. Like, so I'll go back to, so my first theme is lineage. That's what I chose. And kind of by that, I mean like having kids, you know, passing on your name, passing the torch, etc., next generation kind of stuff. But this year is especially hard for me to remember anything besides like what just happened, because we had our second child this year. And that is a lot harder than just having one child. You know, it's just been a tough year for sleep and health and our lives. And it's great, but at the same time, it's horrible. And I feel okay saying that.
Right.
So it's like Chrissy and I kind of have like this mantra in the house where we kind of say to each other, you know, don't let me F this up, okay? And we mean like the kids, because it's hard to keep your shit together with two kids that are just running you ragged. So it's kind of an exercise in your own mental stability, having two little kids. One of the books that really resonated with me in terms of this would be Sheltered. You know, I guess we'll say Sheltered number one, especially, because you have this group of people and their families who are planning for the end of the world and have taught their children that all these survival tactics and needs in the, you know, the inevitable eventuality of societal collapse so that they can live on. And the kids realize that the end is coming and there's not enough resources, so they kill their parents. And I think that's it's a beautiful and fitting kind of sort of commentary on parenthood, of that you try to do the best for your kids and you're going to reap the rewards of it, you know, depending on what that is. So that, you know, there were other examples. I think Lazarus is a really good example of that too, but that's kind of different. You know, that's the idea of family and family dynamics using each other and that sort of thing. But Sheltered is really, really about that parent-child relationship.
And like what can go wrong with it.
Right. What can go wrong? And I think it's impossible to be perfect parents. It's just not possible. You know, that's the thing I really realized this year. But it's almost like every day is the attempt to not be the worst parent you can be.
It's good to have goals.
Yeah, the bar is low, and I try to rise above it every day. I think that's the only way I can feel like I'm successful by the time I fall asleep.
Do you find yourself more affected by reading like fictional parent-child relationships than now this year?
I think I look, and I don't really like to do this with stories, but if it's that kind of thing, I want to know more about what the author is saying. You know, because if it's a commentary on the parent-child relationship, whether it's from the child's perspective or the parent's perspective, it should be a personal story. You know, it can be fantastical.
Right.
But I think it's more powerful. It doesn't necessarily have to be, but it is more powerful if it comes from an authorship's kind of place of introspection, if that makes sense.
As in the author himself or herself has had some experience with it directly?
Well, yeah. I mean, maybe not literally, you know, like in terms of Sheltered, but
sure.
it's sort of the thing, like, you know, say it was a commentary on how parents can, you know, screw their kids up And then maybe that's what I'm taking from it. You know, that might not be the author's intention, but that's what I gravitate towards, like, a significant part of that story.
So it would be more important to you to know that the author had had a contentious relationship with his or her parents?
Or is using this story as a way of working out some of those ideas and feelings?
Hmm. Okay. That's interesting.
Yeah, but it's not always, that's not usually what I care about.
Right. That's why I'm sort of calling you on it, because that is often not something that I feel like you are particularly mindful of.
No. I mean, ultimately, I want to read a good story that makes me think of things.
Right.
But it's not necessarily that important to me of whether the author was thinking the same things.
But parenthood is such a personal, like, struggle and personal success story that I think that it's interesting that of all of the different types of stories and themes from these various stories, that would be what you would latch onto as something that you kind of need the validation of the author's personal experience to, like, lend credence to it.
Yeah, it doesn't make or break things, but it's definitely helpful. I mean, it's the same reason, like, I don't know, like, my wife has sort of, like, these Facebook groups of other moms. Just so they, you know, a lot of the time it's like, I'm feeling this way, or we were just talking about this, or this is what our kids do. Is this normal? And having other people kind of validate, like, oh yeah, that goes on all the time in our house.
No, I completely agree with that. I think that that's something that we do in a lot of different, we as, you know, people, as humanity, we do that in a lot of different segments of our life. I haven't heard you do that in a lot of other stories, this particular theme. So
yeah.
I don't know, Aaron, I think that's like an underhanded compliment that I'm paying you right now. Like, good job sharing your feelings or something.
Thank you. Well, I'm done for now. You can share some more of your own.
Hello, I'm Dr. Stephen Strange. And like I say, always wrong, never right. Ha, 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 poor guy. But seriously, this holiday season, I reflect on the many times comics made me feel something. Like the time I felt sad because I still don't have an ongoing that sells. Or the other time I felt that maybe I could at least co-star in a book with a robot in space. Magic and robots in space, but they said no, and I had feelings. Also, Hawkeye. That guy has a comic. When Kate left with Lucky, right in the old gut, chaps. Even Wong felt something, and I purged his human emotions so he would stop asking for vacation ages ago. This has been Dr. Stephen Strange coming at you with feelings.
So my second theme was harder for me to identify, mostly because when I realized kind of where I was heading with this, I wasn't sure how to frame it. And so I spent a lot more time thinking about how to describe it and, like, why it's important and how it makes me feel than the previous example. Pretty much every week I talk about the themes in various comics that I'm reading with other people, not just you, Aaron. Sorry. I know, right? But this one has come up a lot with the other people that I talk to. And I found myself paying more attention this past year to gender roles in comics, and, like, specifically how, like, female characters are written or drawn and by whom. So if you remember, when I picked up the first issue of Red Sonja, written by Gail Simone and drawn by Walter Giovanni, I was super uninterested in the way that she's drawn, even though I know that that's the way that she's always been presented. But if you also recall, there's that, like, really stunning Fiona Staples variant cover. And I remember thinking, like, why couldn't this be the way that she was always presented? Like, why can't this be the way that Red Sonja's story is told now?
Yeah.
And we also just talked to Simon Oliver about FBP, which is a fantastic book, and I really enjoy it. But we talked about the fact that in the first four issues, there are, like, no women of substance at all. And there was definitely a point in my life where I wouldn't have noticed that in quite the same way. And I wouldn't have questioned it. So I think that what I'm acknowledging is that over this past year, I have started to do that more. Like, that's been something I'm much more conscious of and like, welcoming of that consciousness.
In terms of recognizing feminism and what is, I guess, equality in stories?
I'm not sure that I'm interested in putting any kind of terminology on it, because I'm approaching it entirely anecdotally as opposed to academically. But for me as a reader, I have noticed that the domination of male creative teams actually does affect me. So you have a book like Rachel Rising, which is stunning, and it's full of just really beautifully crafted female characters. And Terry Moore, who's of course male, draws and writes them like so lovingly. And then you have a book like Mind the Gap by Jim McCann and Rodine Escio. Also complex female characters, also a male writer and artist. And there's like tons of other examples. And I love those all. I think they're fantastic and I will not stop reading them. But I did realize this year that sometimes the creative team matters, and sometimes my desire for different representation like matters to me as a reader. Like, it took me fucking long enough to come to this realization, but this definitely did happen this year.
Yeah, and it's hard for me to recognize other than in terms of, like, it really is hard for me to be honest and have, like, an unbiased eye for, I guess that's sort of, true voice of feminism, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it totally makes sense, because you're a dude.
Right, but it's a double-edged sword to dismiss males as not being able to be feminist, but I don't think it really, we just can't be the same as women can be in terms of how you look at that sort of thing.
Sure, but
like,
also,
I gravitate to male writers who write females as long as it doesn't make me think of that person as being a male writing a female. Does that make sense?
It does. And so maybe a more accurate, broader approach to this theme is that I am paying more attention to creators and the relationship between readers and creators than I used to. I was more inclined to judge a book by the story exclusively and less by the perspective of the storyteller.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so I think that balance, it bothers me a lot to use words like equality and balance, where that's not necessarily the end goal that I'm like perpetuating here. And so I don't want to frame this in the trappings of like equal representation or anything like that. I think that it's more perspective as opposed to balance or equality that I'm acknowledging, and that because my perspective as a reader has changed, I'm placing more validity on the perspective of the creator.
Yeah, okay. I think that's reasonable. I mean, just like any book you read for the authorship, and you learn an author and what they write about and how they write. You don't just pick up things blindly, as people will sometimes, I guess, with comics. But at the same time, who's doing it makes a big difference, obviously.
Right. Well, and also the market for the individual character is also interesting to me. So we talked a lot about Captain Marvel this year.
Yeah.
And how the middle arc of that entire book was, I thought, stunning. And yet it was less successful from the sales point of view. And just the difficulty in telling a brand new story with a female character, as opposed to just rehashing old stories but replacing the male roles with female characters.
Right,
and I think
right.
that that's something that you see as more of a struggle with the big two characters and Marvel and DC as a publishing company as a whole. They just have less flexibility, and they just have like years of baggage to overcome. And so putting...
Well, they also have... There's just also just sales behind it. I mean...
Right, that's what I'm saying. So like you look at Carol in a fairly atypical superhero arc, like what happened in the middle numbers of Captain Marvel from about, what was that, like 10 through 14?
Uh-huh.
Like after the first arc, but before Enemy Within began.
Yeah.
And it was lovely. And yet, like, really didn't translate to a lot of readers, especially predominantly male readers. And I thought it was awesome. So, like, why is that? And if the whole point of today is about being introspective, I'm trying to articulate for myself as a reader what was so appealing about that and why I would want to see that more with various characters. And then, hey, surprise, it was written by a female writer. It was written by Kelly Sue DeConnick.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's something for me as a reader to pay more attention to and to not be ashamed of acknowledging, where I've spent so many years of my life being like, oh, I'm just a comic book reader. I'm not a fucking female comic book reader. What's the difference? Well, I don't know. Maybe there is a difference, guys, and that's not a bad thing.
Yeah, it also this is where we get down this kind of rabbit hole of gender and sexuality and spectrums and that sort of thing, because nobody's black or white. There's not female readers. There's not male readers. There's all kinds of everything.
I'm willing to acknowledge that there's a lot of gray area and that the boundaries are very fuzzy. I think that, like, my ultimate takeaway here is that it is actually more important to me than I have let it be in the past. Like, I'm more interested in the strength of a character versus the plot that character is involved in. And that's a new thing for me to acknowledge.
Hmm.
That's all.
Okay.
Personal growth, Myers. It's a great thing.
No, that's fine. I think it's harder for me because I'm not forced to really dissect books that way.
Well,
because
I'm not
the industry the industry caters to me.
Oh, right. Because you're, 35, male, with a ridiculous beard.
Yeah.
A room full of comics.
It is the golden age.
You're the
of
guy.
Comics for me.
Right? Yep.
That's why I buy so many.
Uh-huh. Speaking of...
I'm just perpetuating the system that's failing you and catering to me.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's why we get along so well.
Uh-huh. Well, you want to talk about me some more?
Always.
Great.
Hi, this is James Kaplan, Sinister JHK on Twitter. I love the podcast, and I'm calling the feelings that I wanted to call about, the moment in particular I wanted to call about, is from issue 14 of Saga. It's the moment between Sophie and Lion Cat, and she is talking about herself, and then she starts describing herself, and it's just, the moment when she's talking about what's wrong with her on the inside, and Lion Cat says lying, and then she's reassured, is just one of the sweetest, most moving moments that I've read in any comic in this year or any other. So that's definitely one of my moments of the year. Great podcast. I really love listening.
I guess my second theme would be complexity. I guess that's the only thing I could really come up with that describes it. Complexity of story, complexity of universe. So, we talked a lot of independent books this year, but obviously everyone who listens to the show heard me kind of freaking out constantly about Avengers and New Avengers and then the whole Infinity event. And that's because this was really the year for the complex story to shine. Bigness of a comic book universe. And it's easy to kind of dismiss Marvel or DC books as being kind of substanceless for the most part. You know, entertainment. But I think people do. I think it's, they're entertaining, but they're not necessarily significant.
Okay, sure.
You know, in a literary sense.
Got it.
Whereas other books might, you know, maybe have more easy meat to get down to. But I think that's incorrect. And I think especially with Marvel, and especially these last couple of years, but this year in particular. And I think what Hickman has done with the whole Avengers universe really exemplifies that. You know, it's this team book, and what makes a good team book, you know, important is really what he's done. And so many people kind of dismiss it. It's pretty contentious. Like, a lot of people like Avengers and liked Infinity, but as many as did, hated it.
Why, though? Because I've actually heard a lot more dissension in the ranks about, like, Age of Ultron. And
well, yeah, Age of Ultron has a lot more to nitpick at, I think.
Right, but I've heard quite a bit of praise for Infinity as an event and as an approach to storytelling.
I would say overall, yeah, I think it won more people over than most events ever have. It was certainly the case with me. But, I mean, am I wrong to say that a lot of people kind of dismissed and had a lot of issues with Avengers and New Avengers this last year? Like, the story?
No, you're not wrong, because I was absolutely in that camp at the beginning of the year, and you know that.
Right.
It was very hard for me to make the transition from a team book that was character-driven to a team book that was event-driven. And it took months for me to buy into that as a reasonable approach.
But can I say why I think the event-driven team books are better than the character-driven?
Yeah, I mean, if I told you no, you still would anyway.
I still would, yes.
Right.
But the events in an event-driven team book exemplifies the characteristics of those characters better than getting introspective with them in a team sense. You know, the introspection and the character building comes from the solo book, in my opinion, and the practical application of those learned abilities, growth, etc., come out in the team book. That's the way it should be executed, in my opinion, and I think that's what Hickman's doing.
Yeah, I agree. I think that Hickman brings, like, a sophistication to that world creation and that event creation that, like, hasn't been present in a while. And so I was skeptical.
Not in the mainstream, because, you know, Remender is another guy who does something similar. He just hasn't had his opportunity to do it on the main book. But, right. Like, his X-Force run was a lot like that. You know, it was very event-driven, story-driven character building. And he did that a lot in Uncanny Avengers.
But contained within a single title.
Right, exactly. So that's what I'm saying. In terms of this, like, this is Hickman's chance to do it over the entire Marvel Universe.
Right, and so that was difficult for me to transition to. That's all I'm saying. Like, ultimately, you were right.
But is it because, as comics readers, we want immediacy, and long stories don't tend to fizzle people out really quick?
I don't know, because I think in my case, approaching Avengers as opposed to X-Men, that I bring, like, my personal baggage to the table. So if it doesn't read the way that it always has for me, if it's not an easy read, I think is what I'm saying, then there's like a wall there. Like, this is the book that I grew up with. These are the characters that I should know. This is a story I should be able to follow without having to think about it. If I have to work to appreciate this, then I'm gonna be frustrated, or I'm gonna, like, blame the writer. And that's, like, ultimately, that's not cool of me. And mostly I'm just, like, a jerk about it. But it took me a while to realize what was happening and, like, what the big picture was, and to see it as a growth in the universe and not as a source of frustration for me as a reader.
Okay. Yeah. But this goes also back to, like, what you were talking about following creative teams. You know, for me, I never really doubted this because I've been following Hickman's Fantastic Four and I've read all his, you know, independent books. But I don't know if that's something that is, you know, that everyone has to be in the loop on. So I understood people's frustration because they might not have known him in that way. But at the same time, I think it's worth trying to figure out, like, not having to be so completely passive, like, entertain me. You know, it's okay to do a little bit of work of, like, who is this guy and what is he planning for, you know, if you like something.
Well, and it also speaks to my tendency to read in chunks. So I read a bunch of Fantastic Four in chunks, and it's much easier to see the big picture of some of these big complex events and yeah. this sophisticated approach to mainstream superhero storytelling when you have issue after issue after issue to help propel the story forward.
Yeah, it's true. It's so also, there's a lot of Avengers books, so to me it's like the story was moving pretty quick. So
it was like every week there was another one.
Right. So, but I, at the same time, I mean, people, it goes back to that short attention span too. And I think if people want to complain, they will complain. But, you know, so whatever, I'm using Avengers as my kind of significant book for this theme. But there were other things I read this year. Like even recently, I caught up on Michelle, I don't know how to say his last name, but I'm going to say Fife. He has a series called Copra, which is a self-published series. And
so,
it's
so brilliant.
Yeah, it's sort of like the Suicide Squad, but not without any kind of boundaries with, you know, within any universe. And that's a team book, and it's very introspective too. You know, it's character driven with this overall arc because it's a self-contained world. And it kind of goes back to that, you know, like Remender's Uncanny Avengers or X-Force or something like that. You know, it doesn't have the help of other stuff to build upon this big story. Same goes kind of with like Invincible Universe, which is a companion book to like Invincible and, you know, that whole Kirkman superhero universe. But that's another great series. It's a team book and it's very character driven and it doesn't really have the benefit of other books to build it up. So it really kind of depends on which, like, you know, which angle it's kind of coming from. Does it have other stuff that is building up the characters, and then this is the big story, or do you have to tackle both? And it's a very different approach to writing those books.
Yeah, anything that is kind of ensemble-driven, but yet self-contained, it's much more akin to like a television series.
Yeah.
Where you have like this intimate look at the team and solitary moments with the individual characters to give you a little bit more context, but it's mm-hmm. always the team first.
Yeah.
So, like, I'll give you that. And I think Copra is amazing. And I've been reading that for a while. That's something that Leif Smith over at Mission Comics in San Francisco pointed out to me almost a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's so silly to talk about a unique approach to a superhero team book, but yet it is. And a lot of it has to do with like the aesthetics, but I really enjoy it. And maybe because it's like on its own. So it doesn't have, speaking of baggage, it just doesn't have any of that expectation of known characters. It's really about this creator telling his story.
Yes.
That's awesome.
Yep. So that's my second theme.
Complexity and lineage. That's really fucking deep for you, Myers.
Well, I'm pretty deep. I just don't. I don't share it on this podcast.
Where do you share it?
Well, I have a secret podcast.
Oh man,
it's invite only.
Should I be jealous?
Yeah. Yeah. Very jealous.
Yeah, I'm not. I'm already over it.
Well, everyone should be jealous up until this point because they have not gotten to heard our talk with Colleen Coover and Paul Tobin.
Gotten to heard?
You're the one who made me drink.
I know. I think I did actually surprisingly well, given the amount that I consumed.
Wait till you hear back.
From whom?
From the populace.
Oh, man. You don't think?
I don't know. I think you're great.
Aw, shucks. I think you're great, too.
Here are my top 10 moments in comics that impacted me the most 2013. 5 through 1, these brought the feels. Number 5, Rachel Rising, number 18. page 8, panel 5. After crying out, "Ma, Molly, please, please," Lilith desperately watches Ma, Ma Molly, the angel of death, turn and walk away. Number 4. Thor, God of Thunder, number 11, page 5. Every god in all the universe closed their eyes and prayed to Thor. Thor became the god of gods. Epic. Number 3. East and West, number 4, page 25. For this is the woman who conquered death. Perfect way to end what may be my favorite single issue of East and West, 2013's best new ongoing series. Number 2. The Wake, number 5, page 24. Mom, please don't go. Okay, break out the tissues. And number 1, With a Bullet, Saga chapter 13, page 19. Lying. If this scene and moment didn't bring a lump to your throat or a tear to your eye, then you simply have no heart. Thanks, 2013, and Comics Therapy, bring on 14.
This week on The Couch, we welcome Colleen Coover and Paul Tobin, creators of Eisner Award-winning Bandette, published digitally by Monkey Brain Comics and in hardcover by Dark Horse. Colleen is an illustrator and member of Periscope Studio, and before Bandette, she was known for, among many other works, her erotic comic Small Favors, published by Eros Comics. Paul has written comics for Dynamite, DC, and Marvel, and Dark Horse, including the series Colder and Plants vs. Zombies. His most recent novel, the highly acclaimed Prepare to Die, is now available in trade paperback. Colleen and Paul are also collaborated on the graphic novel Gingerbread Girl and have worked on stories together for Marvel Comics as well. We're really excited to have them both on the show. Thanks for talking with us, guys.
Absolutely.
Thanks for having us.
So I get the impression you're both pretty busy with individual projects and with collaborations. Are there any upcoming comics or prose that we should be on the lookout for in addition to the next installment of Bandette, or other projects that you want to just mention that we missed in the lengthy list that Aaron just recounted?
Well, right. Paul always has like several dozen irons in his fire.
Yeah, I keep pretty busy. We're writing an Adventure Time series together that starts in January. So
yeah. Oh, wow.
We're the co-writers for a six-issue
Adventure Time series
called, what was it called? Flipside. And that's being drawn by an artist named Wookjin Clark.
Hmm.
And he's a member of our studio here in town as well, and he is badass, and it's going to be awesome.
Yeah.
I really enjoy those Adventure Time, like all of those Adventure Time series, both this, like the mini-series and the main title. They really draw on a lot of awesome talent.
They have done, yeah.
They're very varied, yeah. And we had a lot of fun doing this one.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also part of a big crossover at Dark Horse right now. We're combining the worlds of Prometheus, Aliens, and Predator. So I think that starts in June with Prometheus number 1.
Don't forget Aliens versus Predator.
And Aliens versus Predator.
Right. They're really, it seems like this is going to be Dark Horse's year to really resurrect and put out a lot more of that whole Alien, Predator, you know, that whole those whole series.
Yeah, it's going to be we're doing each of them has a four, let's see, my Prometheus story kicks it off. And it's a 4-issue series, and then there's 4 issues of Aliens, 4 issues of Predator, 4 issues of Aliens versus Predator, and the whole story ties together.
Hmm.
So, and then there's going to be a little ending to it, too, as well.
We talked to Chris Sabella a couple months ago now.
Oh, sorry.
So, and he mentioned some of that. I guess it was obviously not as further along in the, or right. as far along in the process, but that's exciting to hear.
That time.
Yeah, it had just been like announced, I think, in the previews and like the press release had just come out for it.
Chris is great to work with. He's one of my favorite writers. I'd known him for a long time, but I thought when he started working on High Crimes, the Comixology Monkey Brain book, that he really took a great big leap forward, and he's continuing that with his work, and he's been a lot of fun to work with. Although half the stories we come up with together we can't use because they just devolve into like the drunken college night writing sprees, basically.
You need to do that as a special edition, like the rejected stories.
Yeah, the stories we'd get sued if we tried to follow.
Right. You got to put it out as a zine, only give it out at cons.
Mm-hmm.
We want to get a sense of your individual work processes. So, Colleen, as a member of Periscope, do you go into the studio every day? Does that change when you and Paul are working on something together?
It does not change. I do. I go in pretty much every weekday. Some days I go to the gym first on my way in.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically an office space in downtown Portland that like upwards of 25 people share rent on. And we sort of Tetrised all these drawing tables into this space. There's not usually all of us there because that would be crazy, but there's usually between a dozen and 15 people in there on any given day working away. Some people are writers like Paul or Jeff Parker or Jeremy Barlow, but the rest of us are more working artists, either working in comic books or some related illustration graphics art field. And most of us are working on our own stuff as well as commercial jobs, but we're all working. And it's a great environment because traditionally, comic book artists will work at home in their home studio alone, very alone.
Right.
and go a little mad. But this, and really, if you're working at home, you can never leave work.
Yeah.
So in this way, we're able to have a space to go to and focus our work energy and then leave it there at the end of the day.
So, Paul, do you go into Periscope also? I didn't realize that. I apologize. I thought that just Colleen did.
Oh, I'm part of Periscope. It's a big part of my life, but I don't write there all that often because it's all my friends. And if I go to a cafe, which is where I have a tendency to write, and if 20 people are talking at a cafe, it's easy to not pay any attention to them because it's just a bunch of strangers babbling about their lives.
Mm-hmm.
But if I go into Periscope, it's, you know, 15 of my friends babbling about their lives. So it seeps into my mind a little more and I can't concentrate. So
that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I go into Periscope basically when my crazy meter gets a little too high and I need to see my friends again. But I generally, if I'm going into Periscope, I know it's going to cost me like about a half a day of work. But sometimes that's a trade-off for sanity, so it's okay.
That's what always makes me kind of wonder. Like, there's the monetization of a creator's time, but at the same time, doesn't your work and productivity kind of downgrade if you don't have any kind of outlet or switching of the environment? You know, especially it seems like in writing that would be very important.
It's absolutely true, and I think I'm a little better writer during the summer because of that. Because during the summer I have a more of a tendency to, like, I'll start at one cafe and then, you know, get on my bike and pedal over to the park and write there for a while and then maybe hit another cafe and things like that. Whereas in the winter I have a tendency to just hunker down at one writing spot per day. And it doesn't refresh my mind as much, so it's a little more problematic, and I have to spend more of my, as you say, the monetization of my brain and my sanity in order to get the work done.
Uh-huh.
That's really interesting. I think the fact that you're both describing leaving the house to do your work, and there's obviously like a very important division there between going off to work as opposed to staying at home and working. And we've talked to so many creators who, like you said, Colleen, have a home studio or who write from home, but there are more and more who are mentioning the need to get out and I guess recharge just with society as well.
Right. Yeah. It's like when we first moved to Portland and I was just working here at home and Paul had a day job, he'd go off to work and I'd be at home all day just listening to the radio or whatever. And he would come home and I'd be, hey, how's it going? What'd you do today? Who'd you talk to? What'd you talk about?
And it'd be just like a crazy puppy just wanting attention and wanting to learn about the world. And I'd be like all tired and just wanting
to. Yeah, he just wants to like have dinner and go to bed. And it was bad. It was really bad. But once I joined the studio, you know, I'd have people to talk to, not just about comics too, but about life or politics or whatever, and like a real adult conversation. But at the same time, you're also put into a spot where you're sort of competing with each other to get work done. It's not really, you know, talked about, but you're like enforcing work ethic. Like if I were at home all day, I might maybe spend 3 hours playing Xbox, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Jeez. I don't know what you're doing. I leave you at home.
You know, that could conceivably happen. But if I'm at the studio, it's far less likely because the Xbox is at home. But
we do both work at home as well, though.
Yeah,
I have a little studio room upstairs where it's one of my primary writing spots, and it's the spot where I can just like spring out of bed and get immediately to work, which is important to me because I was going to say maybe it's just me, but I've talked to a lot of other writers about this, and it seems like the first hour or maybe 2 hours of the day are where the real creativity is. The rest of the day can be a lot of like the work of writing, but the real creativity, the where am I going, how should I spring this into life, that happens pretty immediately in the morning for me. So I need to take advantage of that. And sometimes if it's it's just not possible to jump up, get out of bed, spend an hour getting ready, pedal over to some cafe, and then set up. By that time, I've lost a little bit of the energy.
Yeah.
Just another advantage of working in a studio with other professionals is the cooperation when it comes to dealing with jobs. Like if somebody has a job come up that they don't have time for, there's 20 other people who might be available for that job. And that has been a bonus for a lot of us. I've distributed jobs to other people. You know, somebody wants me to do an illustration, I just don't have time. There's somebody else who could do it or I can recommend, and vice versa. Hmm. So that's another big advantage of having a shared space with other professionals.
Hey, can I ask it's more of a Periscope question, but I'm kind of curious, like, is there a conscious decision in the structure of Periscope to balance it between writers and artists in that way, to where there might be, you know, writers who then need artists on work that they're doing or vice versa, you know, for jobs that come out that way, you kind of have this internal job farm for each other?
I don't think so, no. I think it's like new members are generally chosen by, do we like this person and do they need a space to to work? Right. And often writers don't want to join the studio. I mean, there's
for the reasons
there's
that you
three,
expressed.
What I would say, pure writers at Periscope, me, Jeff Parker, and Jeremy Barlow. And none of us spend very much time there.
Hmm.
So bringing writers in is a little tough, and I don't think it's something that we necessarily like go for. Besides, I think I'm so greedy that I can work with every single one of the artists at Periscope, so I just want to keep it to be my little right. my little play field.
Right.
But on the other hand, like when a project does come our way, it's good to know that there are people. It sort of becomes an accident that we have these really talented artists there available to work. And so sort of organically it happens that we end up working together because, you know, somebody, for example, when the Adventure Time job came up, Boom asked us, well, who are some artists you might want to work with? And there was Wook Jin right there.
Mm-hmm.
So we were like, check this guy out. And I think there were a few other people we recommended, but I think he was on the top of our list.
He was the top of our list.
And part of that was because he's great, but a large part of that too was, you know, that he was there. And it's kind of an out of sight, out of mind thing is you tend to gravitate toward people that you see on a regular basis or interact with on a regular basis, as opposed to somebody that you haven't thought about for a couple of months.
Which is interesting because it's like, it seems like the industry changed so much after the internet, where people could be distributed everywhere. You know, in the 70s or 80s or, you know, up until the early 90s, people had to work in the Marvel offices or the DC offices or something like that. They had to work around each other just to be able to collaborate. And then the internet opened up everything to where people could be everywhere. But at the same time, you didn't have that face-to-face kind of interaction and reminder and collaboration that you just can't really keep, you know, over Skype or, you know, over email or that sort of thing too. So it's almost kind of a throwback, I guess, it seems like, you know, having that collaborative space where people can actually go up to each other and talk about projects and get ideas and get work to each other and that sort of thing.
It's a big thing. It's what we were talking about, like the sanity level of everybody suddenly working alone. And we realized, though, we are actually social creatures. And and our writing and art are also social in a way. There's, I mean, a lot of the artists, I'll go ahead and say all of the artists at Periscope wouldn't be nearly as good as artists if they were just working at home, because an artist is just like anybody else. They'll start to take like little, you know, like shortcuts and go, well, I'll just do this. And plus I don't really know how to draw hands very well. So I'll just kind of skimp on that. But there's always an artist at Periscope that can help you like right on site. You know, it's like somebody's good at this. You mentioned like, do we look for like writers and artists and try to balance that? And while we don't do that, one thing that is nice about Periscope is that there's a lot of different types of artists.
Right.
So, I mean, we have like Erica Mullen and Dylan McConis that do the web things, Ron Randall and Steve Lieber doing the superhero things. Mm-hmm. And that's always nice to have this broad spectrum of abilities, because then you can learn so much, even if you're just going in there. I mean, we have usually two interns at a time, and they're soaking up knowledge like a sponge. But we're all doing that too.
Yeah.
We're just all learning. And even just like watching, you know, being able to, if we're there at the same time, the couple of times that I've been stuck, you know, and be able to turn to Jeff Parker, who's a writer that I really, really respect, and say, well, how would you handle this? And even if he can't come up with it, just the back and forth verbiage helps, you know, kind of jar ideas loose for me.
Yeah, you just need to talk to somebody and the answer might come to you just by having somebody to verbalize it with.
Yeah. And as artists, we cross-pollinate really nicely because like Paul was saying, there are a lot of different avenues of comics that are worked in there. And not only do we share like artistic techniques, but technical ways of drawing. When I first started going into the studio, I was strictly physical art on paper. You know, I would use a light box to sort of trace my initial drawings or to sort of refine my drawings. I didn't own a laptop. Now I almost exclusively draw digitally. The only part of Bendette that I draw on paper is the ink stage, the ink wash stage. Everything else is digital. And that's largely because I learned about, you know, how to do Photoshop, how to use a Cintiq or a Wacom tablet, any of that stuff from other people at the studio. And that goes like through the generations. Occasionally we'll have like a guest come in to work for a day, and there'll be like a guy who's been working since the 90s, but he's been working in his home office. Mm-hmm. And he is still working the same way with, you know, sketches on thumbnails on, you know, typing paper. And then he works that out on a big sheet of paper, and it's all strictly physical, and it's not that it's a bad way to go, it's just that's the only way he knows.
Yeah. Do you find sometimes for those people then that's eye-opening, like it was for you? Or
they look around and they're kind of bewildered sometimes. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that they have any, I don't think that they necessarily feel any reason to change. So, you know, I mean, that's cool,
right?
But but it's just interesting.
Well, lots of people have changed. I mean, not just the guests, but the people that come into Periscope and as members, they change their ways. I mean, there's not too much in the way of straight up just pen and ink paper anymore.
No.
Well, even talking to, I was talking to Ron Randall at last Rose City Comic Con, and it seemed like his work has really changed since the 90s in that way, too. Like, he's learned a lot, you know, some of these modern processor or even coloring techniques and how he was doing things with Trekker now compared to what he was doing, you know, in the 90s with it. And it seemed like it's a very positive experience for him. And I assume he also gets to bring a lot of that historical knowledge, too, to the group.
Mm. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, he's very wise.
Colleen, did you always know that you wanted to be an artist? Like, as a kid, what are, I don't know, like, your earliest memory of drawing or making up stories as a child?
I did always know that I wanted to, but like Aaron was saying, I thought you had to live in New York to do it. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Iowa, so I figured I might as well want to be an astronaut.
You just got it. You're just hoping for that, you know, Marvel Studios, Iowa.
Well, yeah, but you know, I thought you had to physically live in New York City. Mm-hmm. Who knew? And really, it wasn't until I met Paul that I found out different. My earliest memory of drawing was actually I used to watch the Batman television show with Adam West on TV when I was very small, and my earliest memory of drawing was actually Batman and Robin. And Batman was a squiggle, and Robin was a squiggle with an R on its chest.
That's how you knew the difference.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. But so when I had the opportunity to work with Jeff Parker on Batman 66 this summer and do a Batgirl story, that was something that I could not say no to.
Yeah, I was going to say that's sort of destiny coming together, isn't it?
Yeah, very much.
How about you, Paul? Do you have notebooks full of stories that you wrote as a kid? Was it something that you always really had to do?
I don't know that I was ever, I mean, it's something I always wanted to do, tell stories. But as far as like jotting things down, I wasn't a kid that was like actually physically writing stories as much. I can remember getting a few comics confiscated from teachers in like seventh or eighth grade. But as far as actual creation, I mean, my stories were always like turning through my head, but I didn't really sit down and create them as much. No, not until college, at least, and even after college, I think.
Mm. What did you study in school?
Art history, for the most part. I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life at that time. I didn't really understand that I was making a decision about the rest of my life. So I was one of those going to college people that my major was going to college.
Yeah, me too.
In a way, though, that's still a decent education. Like, you know, in terms of just getting the generality, like, that's kind of what I went to school for, too. I got a degree in English literature, and I work on servers all day. You know, it almost doesn't really matter in other than the college experience.
Right. Yeah, I wouldn't mind time machining back and getting a little more out of the college experience.
Yeah, I didn't graduate. Did you graduate?
I did not graduate.
Neither of us actually got a degree. I would have gone back. I think if I had a time machine, I would have taken foreign language and taken it seriously.
Yeah,
but otherwise, yeah.
And how in life are you lacking in foreign languages? Like, what would that have changed for you?
I always regret not having at least one other language to read and understand in order to sort of expand my education that way, by being able to read in the native language. Just because I feel like as a well-rounded person, you should be able to understand other people.
Uh-huh.
Any particular language that you would gravitate towards?
French, probably easier. Although last night we had a Spanish TV show on TV, and it was outrageous, and I thought, I would like to know what's going on, because I think that's hilarious.
Wait, was it Sábado Gigante?
No, it was something else. It was something like that, like a little bit more low rent.
So here's the intensely personal question that you guys don't have to answer. But I'm curious if you collaborated creatively before you started dating, or if it was more of a natural extension of your relationship.
Oh. Did we? I don't think we did.
I can't remember.
I can't remember
which was first, really.
Well, I think you gave me a short script before we started dating, but then that script never happened. I think that our dating life and our work collaboration life has pretty much been the same thing. Because
that sounds less romantic than it should.
No, I disagree. I think that that actually makes it sound like it's a very holistic
process. I agree with
you. It's very much related to like, you guys together, your personalities, and I think that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. The thing is, you know, when we first became friends, I was like, yeah, this guy. But he was saying,
wait, what did that mean?
I wanted to pursue you.
Okay.
But you were seeing that other girl, and then that got taken care of. And
you know, there's no statute of limitations on certain crimes, right?
She's still alive, I swear.
I think we were dating.
Yeah, I think so. Let's decide we were dating.
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, that's the official record at this point.
Yep, it's official now.
I know that we were dating before anything that we worked on together was published.
That works. That'll hold up in a court of law.
Yeah.
question about personal life again. How do you both? This is for you both. Like, how do you unwind from the stress of the industry and deadlines, etc.? I mean, you live in Portland, so I imagine you end up hanging out socially with a lot of other creators as well. I mean, you can't really walk anywhere in Portland and talk to anyone who's not writing or doing a comic of some sort. Do you ever do anything completely non-comics related just to get away for a while?
Well, we both laughed when you said unwind. As if
that was something that we have time to do.
I don't know. What else do we do?
Oh, God, we're boring.
I like to go to burlesque shows.
Yeah?
Most of our friends are comic book people, and that can get a little... That can get a little tedious at times. It's always interesting to talk to somebody outside the industry and see how other people live.
It's interesting, but it's also really difficult for me.
At times. It depends if they have interesting lives.
That's
true. If they're burger flipping.
Well, but even Portland, I mean, even if you're a burger flipper, it's such a creative city at this point. You know, there's so much going on. It's almost sort of insular in a way that I don't feel like it's easy in Portland to get a sense of what, you know, quote unquote, other people live their life like.
It is very much that. Yeah.
Yeah. When I first, the only, I guess, real job, writing is a real job. The only real job that I had in Portland, day job, was working at the Powell's bookstore, the big Powell's bookstore.
Uh-huh.
And that's awesome. And I can remember, like, getting to know the people there was a lot of fun. But it's like you were talking about, they would say, well, what do you want to do with your life? And I would say, I want to be a writer. And they would all just look around and go, every single person that works at Powell's wants to be a writer.
Right.
So it was almost like saying nothing. It was just like saying, well, I just want to keep breathing.
Well, if that's the life of a city, though, that's not too bad. I live down in Eugene, and it's similar, but it's, you know, we still make fun of you, everyone up in Portland.
it's interesting because, like, if we go down to Milwaukee, where Dark Horse Comics is, sometimes I'll be... You know, he'll have a meeting and it won't involve me for a little while. And I'll be at the cafe there and it's full of like soccer moms and in air quotes, regular people.
Yeah.
And I'll look around and I'm like, wow, this is like an entirely different place than Portland, even though it's only like, you know.
Yeah, it's just a suburb right outside of the main city. Yes. Yeah.
It's like 40 blocks south. So.
Yeah.
So that's always kind of interesting and weird. And the thing is that, you know, you end up I think that artists and creative people end up being in these creative insular communities because of that whole tribalism thing that people just naturally do, that they want to be in a place that makes them feel comfortable. I envy people who can live outside of that and still be artistic and creative because it's usually cheaper. but I would be unhappy anywhere else, I think.
Mm-hmm. So both of you have jumped back and forth between pretty explicit adult content, be it sex or horror, and then all ages stories like Bandette. What made you settle on the more all ages approach to Bandette and even Gingerbread Girl? Like, have you ever felt restricted by that choice?
Well, not restricted. I mean, I started out with Small Favors, and that was sexually explicit, and that was a lot of fun, and I felt like that was a good, like, first major project. And I did it not so much out of a desire to be doing, you know, sex comics, but just because I thought it would be fun. And also because I was looking around and a lot of the sex comics that were available were frankly kind of horrible in one way or another, either
pretty primarily focused to one gender too.
Yeah. And, you know, I was like, well, I want something for girls that's actually well done and, you know, done with the desire to make good comics and, that women can enjoy. Weirdly, that was kind of revolutionary and awesome. And people like, really responded to that. But it wasn't my only goal. It wasn't my only goal to do that particular stuff. So then we did Banana Sunday, which was entirely all ages. And then I did stuff at Marvel and stuff like that. It's really the same thing. Telling stories of one type or another to me is all the same thing, especially from the drawing point of view. But it's also gratifying and personally gratifying to be able to tell different types of story, because otherwise I would maybe get bored.
And just having kind of like, you know, all ages does come with a set of kind of guidelines. It could either be restrictive, or I think in a way you could probably see it as freeing, that, you know, here are the boundaries and how do we tell the best story we can that will appeal to everyone and not have, you know, X, Y, and Z in it.
Yes.
Yeah, for me, it's all about character. I mean, when I want to work with a certain type of character, they kind of come with their own setting to a certain degree. I mean, Bandette as a happy-go-lucky, you know, jokester wouldn't work in a horror comic, so obviously it wasn't going to be a horror comic. Mm-hmm. So it's just what type of character I want to write at any certain time. And I don't really understand creators that don't have more than one genre that they work in. And that's been kind of interesting for me as my career progresses, is watching people like scramble to re-genrify Paul Tobin. It's like, oh, he's the all ages guy that's doing Marvel Adventures, so he can't really do, oh, what's he doing with this colder thing? This is terrifying. He's completely, you know, why are you doing that, Paul? And then after Colder was established and people were like, oh, okay, he's a horror writer. And then I started doing Bandette and they're like, well, now I'm just confused.
But that's good, because then you get enough of a portfolio in place to where people go, he's whatever we need him to be. Like,
yeah. And more importantly, I mean, I don't really write as much for, oh, I want this huge career. I write because I want to tell the stories. So if a story appeals to me, that's the way I want to go, whether or not I think that's the, you know, the market or anything like that. So I don't really gear anything towards any direction other than what would be the most fun to work on right now. Mm. And I think it's important to have a couple of different what would be the most fun to work on right now, because, I mean, even just as a reader, there'll be times when I'm like, oh, I don't want to read anything right now, but, you know, barbarians cleaving people in half with axes. And then like 2 days later, you're like, I couldn't think of reading a story like that. I need to read, you know, this science textbook. And then 2 days after that, you're, you know, it's like, oh, this Japanese manga romance is exactly what I want to read. So I think as a writer, I follow those paths as well. You know, at different times, I'm a different writer. And I think it's acceptable and even more energizing to go with the flow.
And it's got to be the same for both writing or art. Like you have to find inspiration in other works, and having, you know, a wide breadth of things to draw upon, and, you know, to look or find, I think, are kind of similar. You either find a new story out of something else, or you look for inspiration in the story you're trying to gel or trying to look to draw. I could see that kind of coming either way, and that's different. As a reader, just a, you know, not a creator, just, you know, as the guy who goes to the comic book shop and picks up comics, I think we read comics differently than the people who are making comics. That seems to be my impression the more we talk to people.
I think that's probably true, yeah.
Because you're immersed in it, and you're, the way you're looking for stories, are you're consuming them differently than we are.
Yeah, it can be kind of difficult, you know. It can be kind of like if you watch, like... If you watch like the ice skating on TV, and there's all these, you know, teenagers in the audience is going, woo, that was great. But there's some dude in the booth going, well, she didn't quite make that turn.
Right.
You know, we're that dude in the booth sometimes. So it can be kind of difficult to look at comics with a non-professional eye. Yeah. So it's always exciting when we find something that's just really, really great.
Mm. There's so many, a lot of creators I know won't read the works done by their friends, just because it's tough to have the friend and the critical eye at the same time. And you don't want to have that moment. It's easier sometimes to say, oh, I just don't read stuff by my friends, rather than to say, you know, I still want to, you know, hang out at your house, and you're one of my best friends. Those are crappy comics.
Right.
Oh.
Well, speaking of comics, what comics should people be reading besides your own? Now that we've established all this before.
Oh, wait, there was that one.
Well, I mentioned Chris Sabella's High Crimes. I really like that. The online book that he does with Ibrahim Mustafa.
Yeah, we love that one.
I've been enjoying Rap Queens from Image. That's a lot of fun.
Yeah, yeah.
That was kind of a sleeper hit for me. It's almost like I was just talking about just a little bit ago. I didn't know that I wanted to read a sassy, woman-oriented barbarian slice people in half with dirty jokes comic, but there you go.
There you are.
I agree. I did not realize that was something that was missing in my life until I did.
Yeah.
It's always a pleasant surprise. Oh, there was something on the tip of my brain, and I can't remember what it was. Something awesome.
I read a lot of European stuff, and a lot of it's like rereading. I'm always reading the Corto Maltese stuff by Hugo Pratt. That's a huge influence on me. I don't know if it's one of those influences that I don't know if anybody would ever say, oh, you know, you're trying to do Corto Maltese too. It's just the... trying to think of a word that means poetry, but isn't quite as poetry sounding. I don't know, just the mood evocativeness that Hugo Pratt was able to do in Corto Maltese is something that I've always responded to and try to work with as a creator.
Where did you get that? I find it fascinating, like a lot of the European comics that we just don't get exposure to here in the U.S., and there's so many produced that we just don't really have in the general market, unless you are really tied into it and order them specially and that sort of thing. A lot of them you're just not going to find at a shop.
Well, you know, part of when we were talking about learning foreign languages a little earlier, that was something that got me, because Colleen and I spent like 3 weeks in Paris once, and it happened to be just as I was starting to write for Marvel. So actually, the first time I ever saw one of my Marvel comics in print, was in a shop in Paris.
Hmm.
But when we were there, there was this huge, beautiful comic stores with all these albums for sale. And it was like one of the first times, and maybe way late in my life, that I was realizing that a foreign language wasn't just a foreign language. It was access to an entire foreign culture.
That's what I was trying to get at before, is that I feel like because I don't have any foreign languages, I don't have access to that mm-hmm. to that foreign culture. I'm at the mercy of translation.
Uh-huh, right. Uh-huh. So like all we're getting... We're not only not getting all the books from France, we're getting like this very thin sliver of what two or three people think would play in America, and it's just not true.
Right.
So many of the things that I think are fantastic, like the Dupuy and Barbarian stories,
mm-hmm, love
and
that.
Miss Don't Touch Me by Carrascote. They've made it here, but they haven't made any impact whatsoever. But to me, they're books that blow me away, and they're the type of, well, I was going to say they're the type of books that I want to do, but that always sounds like, oh, Paul just wants to do that. But, you know, hearkening back to the, what I want to do is always one of like 10 things that I want to do. I really don't, we were talking about that too. I really don't understand how artists can do that. Because I can go to an artist and say, you know, let's do this project that will take me, you know, 3 weeks of my life, but take you 2 years. So the commitment level there is huge. And they can't bop back and forth between genres nearly as much as a writer can, because like I'm compiling a list of, hey, thanks writer or thanks artist that I'm working with right at this time list to tweet. Uh-huh. And part of this, before I say this number, part of this is because I'm having a bunch of artists do like 2 or 3 page urchin stories for Bandette. Uh-huh. But I think right now my number of artists that I'm working with is like around the 25 to 30 range. So it's just, you know, bizarre as far as being able to pollinate all these stories, but it takes so much longer for the artists.
Right.
And it's like, in the project, I don't know how officially this has been announced, but Ben Dewey and I are doing a graphic novel at Oni, and he's just finished the illustration part of it just like a few days ago. And I finished writing it in September of 2011. So he's been living with it ever since then. And to me, you know, he'll send me a page every now and then and go, how do you like this? Does this work with your story? And, you know, it's always, I don't even remember this story. Hold on. You know, so the commitment level between artist and writer is something that's always fascinating to me.
Yeah, absolutely. It's such a disconnect in that way. It's like you write your script and then 2 years later, your book's published.
Right.
Yeah, and that's always been weird for me. Up until Bandette, like, everything that I ever worked on, you know, I would finish it and then send it to the publisher, and then 4, 5, 6 months later, it shows up in shops. And everybody's like, hey, that's great. Congratulations. Aren't you excited? I'm like, I am so done with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, except you still have to promote it and be excited about it because you need to sell it too. And it's like,
sure. I mean, objectively, yeah, I'm excited that people like it and stuff, but I'm like, my emotional connection to that has
moved on.
Faded over time. It's like the difference with Bandette is, when we finish it, it's maybe 4 weeks where it comes out digitally because of that digital format. In the case of the first issue of Bandette, it came out, I think, 6 days after I turned it in. Mm. So that was pretty wild.
That must be fun because then you get to have that same momentum as the readers, you know, in the excitement and the promotion and everything else.
It is very exciting. It is an exciting medium to be working in, or I guess format rather,
yeah.
Not medium. It's the same medium. It's the same thing.
Right.
because it is more immediate, it is very exciting. And also the pressure is on. I had to take a couple of months away from Bandette this summer because I had other projects that I had contracted to that came up all at the same time, including the Batman 66 story. And as a result, I mean, fortunately, I was able to get Bendette number 5 done, which ends the story arc and, you know, provided content for the hardcover, which is out already.
Right.
But the I think number 6 is going to come out in the next couple of weeks because, you know, I had to catch up.
Yeah.
Right. Well, thank you, Paul and Colleen. This was a lot of fun. It's really interesting to me to hear the two perspectives from writing and, like, art creation, but then to see how much you guys were saying the same thing, right? Like, that it's a very overlapping process, and I think that's really fascinating. Do you have any last words of wisdom for us or for our listeners?
I have no wisdom.
I'll just say that, you know, part of the reason that we say a lot of the same stuff is this is stuff we've talked about for the last 20 years that we've been together. So, I mean, these are all conversations that we have delved into pretty in depth over the years. So,
well, thank you for sharing them with us because it's really insightful. And I think especially looking ahead at some of the things that you mentioned, I'm excited about projects. Talk about following creators rather than characters. Like, I don't read Adventure Time. I'm interested in the project that you guys describe because it's the two of you working together. I definitely am not within the target audience of Aliens versus Predator, but because of you, Paul, because of Chris Sabella, because of some of the other creators involved with that, like, it's on my radar in a way that it wouldn't have been otherwise. And so I think it's actually really helpful for readers, I think, to get a chance to hear you guys talk about your processes, and hopefully it like opens up some of these projects to more potential readers as well.
Yeah, I hope so too. And it's, what you're talking about there has always been fascinating to me, that there are two types of readers, the people who will follow creators and the people who will only follow just characters and things like that. And there are some people who, you know, love, like, think that, you know, the work that I'll do on, you know, one book is the greatest thing they've ever read, and they want so much more of it. But if I step into another book, they won't care. That's just like, that's not their narrow field of interest. And
right.
I think both ways of reading are valid, but it's just
right.
Interesting.
Yeah. And I should point out that you're working on Prometheus with Juan Ferreira, who was the artist on Colder.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wonderful.
And I think of Juan, your partnership with Juan is really interesting to see from the outside, because we work, you know, we work together pretty intuitively. And I think the intuitive working relationship that you have with Juan is similar, although very much darker and more scary.
Yeah, as soon as Juan and I finish the 4 issues of Prometheus 2, we go right into more Colder. So there'll be lots more Colder on the way.
Oh, good. That's something that's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's wonderful. Yeah, Colder for me was such a, it was a great miniseries, and especially seeing Juan's art. That was the first time I'd seen his art, and it kind of made me go like, whoa, who is this guy?
Well, it's weird.
I think he's opened a lot of eyes.
It's weird because, in a way, I feel like it's the first time I saw his art, too, even though we had done, like, hundreds of pages of Falling Skies material together.
Uh-huh. But that was inked by somebody else.
It was inked by somebody else, and it was, like,
colored by someone else.
So, like, when Juan got his chance to really cut loose on Colder, it was, like, I felt like he was an entirely new and just amazing artist, and was real. I think it's been a breakthrough book for him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we've already got some art for the next Colder stuff, and he's doing just as creepy stuff. So I think my entire script for the first issue is Juan just draw creepy things.
Uh-huh. Well, he's very good at it.
He certainly is.
Well, we're gonna let you go, but thanks again so much, Colleen and Paul, for taking the time to talk with us today.
Sure, absolutely. It's fun.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And thanks everyone else for listening to another episode of Comics Therapy. Remember to pre-order your print comics, especially small press and creator-owned works, and subscribe to them digitally whenever possible. Show notes are available on comicstherapy.com. We hope everyone enjoyed our introspective year in review. See you next week. You are.
Shooting star.